You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny, and very, 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 very windy day. Don, this north wind is just drying everything out.
Yeah, it's November 6th, Wednesday, November 6th, 2024, as Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast on November 7th. By the time it airs, the wind will have died down. But this is pretty important for gardeners here in Northern California, and they're having a similar Santa Ana wind event, actually gustier and stronger, lots of fire warnings going up in Southern California, lots of wind, north wind. We've been having gusts up to 25, 30 miles an hour, actually up to 44 miles an hour today. And let's do the temperatures first, and we'll come back to the wind because that's a little more relevant to gardeners. Today, Wednesday, 69 degrees, sunny, and they call this breezy. Tonight will be clear and 40 degrees. Thursday, they have the broadcast, 68 degrees and sunny. The wind will be dying down. Here's the important data point. When the wind dies down and it gets still and it's November, the nights get cold. Thursday night will be, according to the Weather Service, 37 degrees. The coldest night of the year to date. And an important data point if you still have your houseplants out on your porch, as I do. Friday, areas of frost. Got that? Friday, June. November, Friday, November 8th, frost. That's not unusually early. It's earlier than average. I guess that's the best way I can put it. And this is not going to be a killing frost, although it wouldn't be great for a houseplant that's sitting out on your front porch. Reminding myself, to-do list, bring houseplants in from front porch. Friday night, 39 degrees, mostly clear. Saturday, mostly sunny. And then we have a sort of a weak storm front coming through. Saturday will be slight chance of showers. Saturday night, slight chance of showers, partly cloudy and only 42 degrees. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 66. Sunday night, a chance of rain after 10 p.m. Mostly cloudy with a low around 49 because of the cloud cover. Monday, which is a holiday for many people, Veterans Day, showers likely. Not driving rain, not an inch of rain. I keep looking up the extended discussion on this. Each of these little storms coming through, a quarter inch, a half inch, maybe some snow up in the mountains, but different pattern. Veterans Day, showers likely, mostly cloudy, a high near 63. That's right, a high near 63. Monday night, a chance of showers, partly cloudy with a low around 42. Then clearing up Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 62. Now let's go back to these winds. The humidity is very, very low. As we're recording this on Wednesday, it has been windy for about 36 hours here in the Sacramento Valley, and the humidity through that whole period has been very, very low. Why is this relevant? Because a whole lot of people have been reseeding their lawns, scattering wildflower seeds, planting out vegetable seedlings, planting shrubs and trees, going to native plant sales and buying native plants and putting them in the ground, and so on. Each of those different categories has a little bit different concern with this kind of low humidity and gusty wind. If you seeded your lawn within the last 7 to 10 days, it's a pretty good chance you'll need to reseed it. I hate to say that, but there's a pretty good chance you'll need to just go buy some more seed and go out there and throw some more out. You're not going to lose 100% germination, but you could lose as much as 50% germination. The reason I say that is I just went out to look at where I had seeded my meadow with some new grass that I'm testing. About half the seed appears to have literally blown away. It's somewhere. It is somewhere on the property.
You didn't mean that it wouldn't germinate because it was too dry. It
just too,
blew away.
Yeah, it depends on what stage you're at. I put that seed out about 7 days ago, and it hadn't yet started to germinate, and so it hadn't even, you know, rooted into the soil. And it was great weather, by the way, for doing it when I did it. It was overcast, and we even got a little bit of rain, but it didn't get going. It's about 10 days for germination, and so a fair bit of it is simply gone. And I know that it blew to the south, so I know roughly where it's gone to, and I will have probably little bands of grass where the seed got caught by, you know, existing grass that's there or whatnot. But there are large areas where I simply don't see any grass seed. Even if I had covered it with compost, that would have blown away as well. Many years ago, we were landscape contractors. We would do lawn renovations in the fall, starting in about early to mid-October, and we'd try to get them done by the end of November. And every now and then, when we would do this, we'd have a wind event such as what we just went through, and we'd have to go back and just put more seed down. So it's not like you have to do all the initial prep again. You don't need to put any more fertilizer down if you did that. That's all fine. But the grass seed either blew away if it had just been put down within the last few days, or it's just withered, unfortunately, because those little roots are very vulnerable to drying out. And there's almost no way you could water it enough to keep it moist during that kind of a wind event. You would need 4 or 5 minutes of watering every couple of hours. We watered our entire nursery, all the container plants, twice yesterday in November. So we are seeing very low humidity, and that would affect young seedlings of grasses, and I hate to say this, unfortunately, wildflowers as well, depending on their stage. Now, wildflower seed, in many cases, like poppies, isn't likely to blow away. It'll just sort of nestle into the little, you know, gaps in the soil and just hang out there waiting for more appropriate germination conditions. But some of the others, which are light and fluffy seed, might simply have gone to another part of your property where hopefully they'll come up, but probably not where you intended. So if you seeded anything, to repeat, within the last, say, 7 to 10 days, you probably need to go ahead and just get some more seed and scatter it out there. And again, that's all you need to do. You don't have to go rent any equipment or anything like that. You've just lost some percentage, and probably a pretty high percentage, of germination. Newly planted vegetable seedlings will definitely need water once a day thoroughly. That's probably fine. If they're still in the little pots, our little packs of vegetables that we have at our garden center right now, where we have hundreds and hundreds of them, great time to plant those things. We were watering them 2 to 3 times during the daytime as that north wind was coming in, because they dry out that quickly. Now, I do have a success to report. It was 2 years ago, I think, that I replanted peas 4 times and gave up. All right, this time I've moved my vegetable garden way out into a field, and at the very edge of the field, furthest from everything else, there's a little fence, and I planted a whole bunch of peas 10 days ago, and there's no damage on them. So they've gotten past the vulnerable stage. This is really an important thing. For those of you dealing with white-crowned sparrows, they seem to really like pea seedlings and lettuce seedlings and others when they're in that first 2 to 4 inch stage. That was what was driving me crazy that time. I'd plant them, they'd come up. I'd think, oh, I should cover that and go off to work and come home at the end of the day, and they were gone. Well, this year, the planting is so far out in the field, they would have to fly in a very vulnerable manner across a big open area to get to them. So will I have concerns about ground squirrels, turkeys, gophers, and other wildlife? In this particular instance, I've gotten them past the white-crowned sparrows. Let's look at a couple things we haven't done here. First of all, KDRT is community radio, so we do rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear at the Davis Garden Show, all the other great programming here at KDRT, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. We always have places and people that we like to mention. I did pull up the Bohart Museum of Entomology. They have fall public walk-in hours. You can just go there and walk in Tuesdays and Wednesdays in the afternoon, 1 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. Walk in and look at the amazing collection of insects of the Bohart Museum of Entomology. And let's see, we had a radio show to talk about. Oh yeah, That's Life is a radio show at KDRT. You can.
That's mine.
That's your life. 10 a.m. Let's see, Thursdays, 10 a.m. to 11. That's Life. Lois Richter, what have you been up to recently, Lois?
My show has now been moved from 11 to 10. Yep. So Thursdays at 10 will be my new show, and then Thursdays at noon will be our new show.
Let's back up here. On Thursday, if you're listening to the show live, you just missed Lois's show, which was 2 hours prior. And who did you talk to, Lois?
Jatan, actually. She is one of the producers here at the station. She's a psychologist, and she runs a show called Heart to Heart. Yeah. But this particular program wasn't about being a show. It was about being French. She is very French.
Yes.
And so we talked about what that was like to live your life in a different language than you grew up with.
So if you all found that hard to follow, go to cadre.org and click on the schedule guide. You'll find it all there. Okay, we had a couple of email questions and comments, so let's pick up with those right now.
All right. Well, Tanya writes back, hello, Don and Lois. Well, the stars finally aligned for me to go over to the neighbor's house to plant the hedge on Saturday. This is the one that we've been talking about for a few times. We both worked in the yard digging holes, filling them with water, and planting the pineapple, guava, bottle brush, and grevillea plants. They are nice and healthy, and it was a perfect day for planting.
Yes.
But there is another issue. I had no idea how much crabgrass and Bermuda grass there was in the planting area. I pulled it out and the areas where the plants went in, but there's still a lot in the area. See attached photos. My idea is to go back with 100% cotton sheets and make a lasagna to kill the grasses. Put down cotton sheets, put down compost, which I get free from the city of Sacramento, put down cardboard, put down a thick layer of mulch. Will this do the trick? The neighbor who will cut back the grasses as much as he can beforehand, and we dug out some, but this seems like the world's longest project. But it's thank you again for your expertise. I want to make this as easy for the neighbor as possible, as he is not a gardener at all and is motivated to put in the work to make it carefree in the future.
Well, the first thing I want you to do is make sure of what kind of grass you have. We go through this a lot where someone will come in. Now, you said both crabgrass and Bermuda grass, and people use those terms interchangeably, but they are two very different grasses. Crabgrass comes up from seed, grows rapidly through the season, spreads outward from a single seedling to cover an area maybe 3 feet across, puts up flowers at the little what I call helicopter seed heads. Bermuda grass has very similar flower structure, but crabgrass has a wider leaf blade. This is most important, is an annual. Crabgrass grows, flowers, seeds, dies. Now in November, with nights getting into the 30s and then frost, it will look like it's dead. And indeed, that plant is dead. Why is that a problem in your lawn? Because now you have about a 3 foot area that was covered with that grass plant that is dead, and you'll pull that out and it's going to be bare soil underneath. Bermuda grass, as anyone knows who's ever worked with it, is not an annual, it's a perennial. And while it spreads out from a single piece of rhizome, it's almost never coming up from seed, it's usually coming up from a piece of stem. It runs out from that, can cover 2, 3, 4 feet in a single season, more to the point, rooting as it does and beginning the process of colonizing whole big areas. Of the two, I'd much rather deal with crabgrass than Bermuda grass, because Bermuda grass, once it gets in, you've let it go for a couple of years, you have a pretty big area covered with a perennial grass, not an annual grass. So it'd be important to know which one you're dealing with. In either case, I'm going to just suggest you skip a couple parts of your lasagna and just do the Lois Richter approach, where you get a giant pile of arborist wood chips dumped in your driveway and bury everything. And as I said a couple weeks ago with leaves, you can also go as deep as you want. You can go as deep as you want with arborist wood chips. You can go as deep as you want with leaves. If you have great big leaf trees like sycamore or mulberry, each house I've lived in has had one of those two species, and I've taken those leaves and buried things in them. The arborist wood chips, of course, are longer lasting, but either of them will do the job. And I have a concern about a couple of these layers. So let's go through them one by one.
Let's talk about this sandwich.
Lasagna, whatever you want to call it.
Okay. So
casserole. This is casserole gardening.
Tanya was saying first they're going to put down cotton sheets.
Don't do that. So the reason I'm concerned about that is that something like that will keep the water from soaking in. So if you can watch this happen, it's like putting down landscape fabric. So when you put it down, water will accumulate on it, puddle up. It will eventually soak through, but it does slow it down. So it typically increases runoff, especially in the early part of any storm. So that's the big drawback. Now, cotton sheets will breathe somewhat, but the other issue with things like that is they reduce air exchange. So I prefer not to have that kind of semi-impermeable layer put down.
So I know why they're saying cotton rather than polyester, because cotton is a natural fiber which eventually will decompose, whereas if you have a plastic fiber, it's not going to decompose.
But cotton would take a long time. I mean, yes, it will decompose, but it'll take a year or more to break down. So anything, okay, okay, second.
And the second layer, she said, was compost.
Great. Free
from the city. Now, I'm assuming compost is like we get from this, our city, so it's really truly compost.
Yes, if they call it compost, it has gone through a process of piling it up, bringing it to an internal temperature of, I think it's 140 or 160 degrees minimum, and they monitor that and they verify it. And what it contains, of course, is who knows what stuff they've picked up off the streets and such, but if it has been properly composted and ground up and such, there's no concern with pathogens or weed seeds, typically, if it has been properly composted. So that would be great, and a layer, doesn't matter how deep it is, 1, 2, 3 inches deep, that will improve the soil in the long run, because as it breaks down, it'll filter in and go into those macro pores and enrich the soil and make it more friable. So the compost layer is great.
Okay. And then she said putting down cardboard.
Okay, now, same.
Cardboard, again, is impermeable. So that's going to...
Well, sort of.
Runoff, right?
Yeah, not all cardboard is created equal. I've read lively discussions at Dr. Linda Chakraskot's blog, the garden professor's blog about cardboard. She's very much against it. Part of it is that a lot of cardboard is impregnated with stuff, wax and other materials that prevent it from breaking down. And also, key thing, prevent water from penetrating and prevent gas exchange. So I consider cardboard... This has gotten to be controversial, honestly. I'm not a big fan of cardboard under... compost, but everybody's doing it because they don't want to use weed killers, so they just want to do something like this and smother out the grass. It does reduce water penetration for as long as it's there, and it does reduce that for several months. Cardboard takes longer to break down than most people seem to think, in our arid region especially. So I don't like that particularly. If you do it, make sure to get cardboard that is just cardboard, not something that's waxy or coated with anything. And
you won't know if you
well, you can if you look
in the mail. How do you know?
If you look at it, you should be able to tell it's got a shiny residue on it. But I mean, I'll just back up here. You really don't need the cardboard. That's just to exclude light and keep the plant from resprouting. Well, the next layer will take care of that if you do enough of it. So let's move on to layer number four.
A thick layer of mulch. Now, yeah. I am partial to arborist wood chips.
Yeah. Well, and we don't really care what kind of mulch it is all that much. The main thing is, if you prevent photosynthesis, the plant can't grow. There's only a very small number of plants that can grow without photosynthesizing. They're mostly parasites. And everything else, Bermuda grass, crabgrass, you name it, if you bury it and keep burying it, it can't grow. This even theoretically goes for woody plants. You know, if they're sprouting through, you cut them off, bury them again. It may be harder with some plants than with others, for sure. And there are certain types of plants, and I think we just talked about this a week or two ago, the ones with needle-like leaves, fescues, nut sedges, will push right up through even a 6-inch layer of arborist wood chips. Well, chop them off, bury them again, and just keep doing that. So the key is, when you get that giant 15-yard pile of arborist wood chips, you also do what Lois did, which is you take some of them and you just leave them off to the side in a big pile in your backyard or nearby wherever this project is, and you be prepared. If you go out there, you see something green, you either take a hoe and chop it off. If it's an annual, that probably will take care of it, or you take a scoop shovel and you bury it, and you just keep doing that. But I do want to mention, with Bermuda grass, it's about to go dormant. So you'll think you've got control. And almost anywhere in California, Bermuda grass starts to green up and grow in late March, early April. And so you'll need to be very, very diligent, especially, you know, poke your head over, look on your neighbor's side, because he may not be out there as often keeping an eye on this. It can easily push up through 4 to 6 inches of arborist wood chips and then run over the surface. I can tell you it'll pull out really easily when it does that, but don't let it get away from you, because if it does that, it will have the whole place to itself and have no competition whatsoever. So just keep burying it. If that's your preferred method of dealing with this, just smother it. And I don't think you need any of those. I don't want the cotton sheets. I'd prefer not to see the cardboard. Just get a giant pile of wood chips if you can manage that. Now, bear in mind, Lois, how big was that pile?
It took up almost 2/3 of my double wide driveway.
Yeah.
And it was more than waist high.
Yeah, it's about, I once calculated, it's about 80 or 90 wheelbarrow loads. And so
it's much more than that.
Well, that's a 3-cubic-foot wheelbarrow. You probably have a 2-cubic-foot wheelbarrow. So 120, 130 wheelbarrow loads. It's not hard. None of this is difficult. It's just wheel it and move it. So if you've got, you know, inexpensive labor on hand, like a relative, great to go forward with that. But keep some extra so that you're prepared for the follow-up, which in the case of Bermuda grass will start probably about April.
So I have had someone come and distribute the chips for me and everything, and he was very, very careful. We have an edge where the lawn or the chips come to the sidewalk. And so before he put the chips down, he went to that edge and he dug out a little area, yeah, a few inches wide between the sidewalk and the other place. And he just took it back a little bit so that when he put the chips in, the chips were at the same level as the sidewalk.
Right.
And they didn't just float away, blow away, whatever. So at that point, if you are doing that, if you have a sidewalk for an edge, you can dig out the Bermuda grass that's right there, then cover it with chips, and you're more apt to get coverage because this stuff will sneak out the side. It really will.
Yeah, it'll come out the edges. It'll come up on, you know, in the nearby garden borders where you didn't realize it had already penetrated. You just have to keep after it. And I, of course, there are various weed killers out there that you could go buy and use. But if you're diligent, you can do it this way. I had a customer who rid an entire front yard of Bermuda grass very successfully using, in her case, straw and manure. I was there shortly after it had been installed, which was quite pungent. She did go to the neighbors and tell them what she was doing, thank goodness, because you don't realize when you get that much manure delivered exactly how fragrant it's going to be. But she put a foot of straw and then a bunch of manure and some more straw on top. And she set a sprinkler out there because she did this in the early summer, which is actually a really good time to do it with Bermuda grass. It's really just getting going. And she watered and watered and watered to get all the straw hydrated, get all the manure hydrated and water to, you know, several inches deep. She did that once and then she did it again a couple of weeks later and on through the summer. And when I visited a couple months later, the entire center, in fact, most, I would say 90, 95% of the lawn area had been killed out very successfully. It was coming up on the edges, as Lois is describing, everywhere she couldn't go deep enough. You can't put a foot of straw next to the sidewalk or else it's just going to slump out onto the sidewalk. She did find, though, that hand pulling that was extremely easy because the Bermuda grass that had run into an area that was a combination of soil, manure, and straw rooted so loosely that in 5 minutes she could pull almost everything out. And she did that all through the summer. It didn't take a lot of work. It was just a few minutes every couple of weeks to make sure another little piece of it hadn't come up. And it is the edges and the margins, the places you're not thinking of that is likeliest to come back. I know the person who lives in that house now, at probably 20 years later, and there's barely any Bermuda grass in the front yard. And it would be very unusual for someone to be able to say, I got completely rid of Bermuda grass by mulching it out. But this person did by mulching it and monitoring and catching it early. That's really the key. With any weeds, we'll tell you over and over again, you know, the 2 to 4 leaf stage, you can get good control. Well, with something like Bermuda grass, any little piece of the stem can sprout. And if you just, you know, I spent many, many hours digging up Bermuda grass as a teenager. If you get it at that stage, it's 1 minute. If you wait through the summer, it's run 3 feet in and begun to root at every node. So get ahead of it, bury it where you can, dig it out if it has to be dug out on the edges and the corners. There's a variety of weed killers ranging from the very familiar ones to some of these top kill materials. The top kill ones are fast acting. Some of them are even organic certified. They can be useful up to a point, particularly for things like crabgrass, which is an annual. You can actually kill a young seedling with some of these top burn materials, but they won't work on something like Bermuda grass. You're just going to be frying the foliage, but it'll sprout right back up. So be prepared to be diligent. Check it every 2 to 4 weeks. Any little bit that's coming up, get that pulled out on the edges, expansion joints in your concrete, places you weren't really thinking of, but you can successfully bury Bermuda grass, and you'll definitely be successful with crabgrass because the seedlings can't germinate under a few inches of arborist wood chips. And they aren't the only option. I mean, if you don't really want to go that route, you, of course, can order bark. It's not my absolute preference because bark is hydrophobic. So bark actually is more of a pathway material to me than a soil improving material, but it's equally good for shading out weeds. And so if you don't mind having 3 or 4 inches of bark where you're walking or something like that, that's something you can buy by the bag. You can have it delivered in more discreet units than 15 yards. It's something that's pretty easy for you to install. So a lot of people now are going to compost in areas where they want to improve the soil. wood chips where they want to just smother out the weeds and improve the soil in the long run, and then fine or pathway or shredded bark where they're going to be walking. And that actually makes a very attractive combination and is best for the soil in the long run to have it reduce that compaction. Because part of what you're describing is someone taking a wheelbarrow, what, 120 times, and going back and forth from the driveway to the backyard in soil that's maybe getting progressively muddier. You're actually doing structural soil damage when you do that. So if you're going to be doing that, put down some planks or put some bark where the wheelbarrow is going to go and reduce the soil damage from that. If your soil happens to be saturated, compaction of saturated soil is actually really bad for it. So keep that in mind as you embark on this process, pun intended.
Two questions, three questions. So this, if this is Bermuda grass, then it's
from the picture, dormant. It looks like it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going dormant. So it'll be brown in the winter, right?
Yep.
So would it matter if they didn't do this project until February?
Well, yeah, true. Yes. The Bermuda grass is going to go brown in November. And in most of California, it doesn't green up again until March or even April, depending on where you are. So if you wanted to wait, as far as that part goes, sure. However, a lot of grassy weeds are going to come up with the rain. Not crabgrass, not Bermuda grass, but a lot of the other grassy weeds, the winter grasses that we get. They're pretty easy to control with a weed eater, but you could go ahead and, you know, install the bark and the wood chips now if you wish to.
And when one is doing this project, looking at the pictures that she sent us, do you recommend that they mow or whack the weeds or do something to get rid of it before they put on the mulch? My thought was that mulch is going to kill anything that's there.
Oh, yeah, you go deep enough, you wouldn't even need to do that. Most people probably would scalp it off first just for appearance sake. But yeah, mulch
will definitely vary. Bark on it, it doesn't matter.
Depends on how much you have. Depends on how deep it's going to go. The deeper, the better. And by the way, just a reminder, folks, leaves are great for this purpose. If it's winter weeds that you're dealing with, this is what we always did in our old house, lived under two fruitless mulberries. So for the backyard vegetable garden, which, you know, you never plant as big a winter garden as you do summer garden, there are big areas that I wasn't planning to plant. So I would just take all those leaves. And I remember putting them 2 feet deep on the vegetable garden. And if a normal rainfall winter, they would just break down, improve the soil, and the winter weeds would have been shaded out. So make use of those leaves. There's no real reason to send them off to the landfill.
And the other thing is, you mentioned using bark and you can get it in a bag. That's going to be much more expensive than calling chipdrop.com.
Isn't it
go ahead, sign up, put your name, and eventually there will be a pile of chips in your yard. So you've heard me talk about this since May when I placed the order, and then July when it came. And now it is, as of Halloween, the day before Halloween, we finally got all the chips out of the driveway. I really wanted that to happen before Halloween.
6 months.
I really did. Okay. Things are spread out where I had wanted them, and there is a VW size pile in the backyard, so we can use that next year if we want it.
Okay, next question.
Well, we have Chinese pistache in the area, and they're changing color. I noticed when I was driving around yesterday that some of them are this beautiful, bright, gorgeous fall color, and then some of them are less colorful. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, is that a male-female thing? I know that there are male and female pistache trees, but is it a gendered thing or is it something else?
Well, years ago, I was talking to a naturalist locally who had made the observation that, in his opinion, the female Chinese pistache were less colorful foliage in the fall than the male Chinese pistache. And in general, you know, I would concur. That was in the old days when Chinese pistache, Pistacia chinensis, a very, very popular shade tree in this area. We've been planting them in the Sacramento Valley for over 100 years. There are many very old ones in Davis, 60, 70 years old, and it is the tree that gives the spectacular fall color in our area. Not a native tree. It's obviously, as the name suggests, Chinese pistache. It's an import and does very well here, reasonably drought tolerant. I've seen them in unirrigated landscapes. And for the first about 20 years that I was in business, I could only get Chinese pistache that were grown from seed. With the seedlings, when you grow them, you have a 50-50 chance of male and female. And some of them have great fall color and some of them are not so great. And so you just, it's kind of luck of the draw. In fact, the Western Garden Book, Sunset Western Garden Book, used to tell people, go to your nursery in the fall so you can see the trees in fall color and choose them for the best fall color, which honestly, as a retailer, drove us crazy.
It didn't work because your nursery area is different than the climate, the microclimate where they're going to plant the tree.
Yeah, so the first variability that you would see was genetics. It was variability of the color itself. I have a number of seedling grown pistache trees on my property, and some of them are yellow and some are orange and some are red. I think they're all pretty, but they're not this strong, intense red that everybody wants. Probably about 20 years ago, more of the growers started doing the grafted male cultivar, Keith Davey. There's another one out there called Pearl Street, but it never really caught on. So Keith Davey is the most common Chinese pistache you're going to find in nurseries if they're selling the grafted cultivar. That one has absolutely consistent flame red fall color. I mean, it's very, very bright red. And it's a male tree. So the male trees don't have the red berries, which some people don't want. I will say about the berries of pistache, I have male and female trees. They're dry. I mean, it's not like you're getting squishy berries all over the ground, but there's a lot of them. A single female pistache would produce many thousands of drupes, as we call them, fruit each year. They're colorful, they're attractive. The birds absolutely love them, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But there's a litter factor, so a lot of people simply don't want that. So they want the male tree. The male tree does flower for about a week in the spring. So you do have the litter of these interesting flower structures. They're not really noticeable, but suddenly you notice this stuff and their pollen on the ground. But that's it. And so you don't have the issue of the berries in the winter.
Color, doesn't position in the world make a difference? In other words, if they're on a south facing slope or a north facing slope or in a, you know, in more shade or less sun or
Well, yes. The question of why they color up at different times, I've actually tested that inadvertently. I have three of the Keith Davies specifically that I have planted on my farm in different places. One of them is closer in to the house and it's somewhat sheltered by bigger trees. The other two are out in the field. One of them is in blazing red color right now and has been for over a week. The one near it is just beginning to turn color. The one closest to the house isn't even close to turning color. They all turn the same beautiful shade of red when they do turn color, but it varies by as much as 3 weeks between these. So we know what that tells us, ipso facto, it is not genetic because they're all clones. And so they're in different locations. So I suspect soil nutrition and watering could be factors. These are all watered fairly similarly. I tend to deep water these trees every couple of weeks, and I don't think I've been that different between them. So none of them are particularly drought stressed, which is a factor sometimes in how early Chinese pistache turn color. Not in my case. It's location. It does appear to be just the local climate that that tree is in as to when it turns color. As to what color it turns, if you absolutely want that really red one, you should go buy the grafted male cultivar Keith Davey. If you buy a seedling grown tree, it's going to vary. I think the seedlings are interesting. I have a grove that I carefully selected of seedling trees on my property back before I could get Keith Davey. What I actually did was we bought a whole flat of seedlings from a grower who was doing them as liners, what we call them in the industry, to sell to wholesale growers who are then going to grow them on to sell to you later. But I bought them in these little 3-inch pots. We left the whole flat of them, 49, out until they turned color. The ones that didn't turn color, I threw away. The remaining 12 I kept, 12 out of 49 that had really nice fall color. Not all the same, but really nice fall color. I planted those out, and over time, I got down to where six of them actually grew. And of those six, three are female, three are male, 50-50, all right. And the females set very heavy crops and have okay fall color. It's pretty. And the males have, one of them's bright. Bright, intense red, one's orange, one's yellow, and so forth. So, if you do them from seed, you'll get variability and you'll also get about 50-50 female. Now, what's interesting about the female trees, they set huge numbers of red fruit. They start out blue and they turn to red. Interesting fact, all that red fruit on the Chinese pistache is non-viable. Only the blue fruit on the Chinese pistache has a viable seed in it. Otherwise, I would have thousands of seedling pistache on my farm, and I get a very small number of them. But one of the good things about having a business right near a major agricultural land grant university is you get professors who are interested in obscure and arcane topics. And there is one who had his grad students, I assume, cut in half, thousands of Chinese pistachio fruit drupes, as we call them, and cut the seeds open to see if there was a viable embryo in there. Of the thousands and thousands that they cut open, first of all, the red ones were not viable. The blue ones were. So, and it's maybe like 5% of them that are blue. So that's one important point there. Why were they not viable? Well, Chinese pistachio is pistacia. Pistacia vera is pistachio nut. Pistachio nut growers that a significant number of their pistachio nuts are blank. It's frustrating to them to harvest all those nuts, take them to the processor, and find out that 10, 20, 30% of them have no nut in them. So in the case of Chinese pistachio, it's more than 40% that simply don't even have a viable embryo. They're producing a fruit parthenocarpically, as many fruit trees do as well, but there's no viable embryo in there. Well, that's only 40% or so, maybe 50%. What about the other one? Other ones? Well, there is a little wasp in this area, talcid wasp, I believe it's pronounced, which burrows into them and eats the nut of the remaining 45% or so. So literally less than 5% of the seeds of a Chinese pistachio tree are viable. That's one of the reasons that even though we've been planting them here for over 100 years, they aren't wildly invasive. If a significant percentage of those fruit had viable seeds in them, Chinese pistachio would be everywhere. There was a different species, Pistacia atlantica, which was planted for a little while by the city of Davis as a street tree, planted some near the library, some near in the elementary school that's next to it, if you folks know on 14th Street where those are. Very recognizable because the berries of Pistacia atlantica are all blue and all viable. Oh. Very, very quickly, with 30, 40 years ago, they realized this tree is going to reseed everywhere. They stopped planting them. So there's a very small number of those around, but you'll recognize them with just the blue seed, and there's a slight difference in the leaf structure. So that one shows what Pistacia chinensis would be doing if it didn't have so many non-viable fruit, non-viable seeds.
Well, the seed may not be viable, mm-hmm. but the fruit itself is edible.
Yes.
And I know that because you can tell when winter has arrived, because the yellow-rumped warblers arrive for their winter visit, and they go and they hang those female trees at the senior center. So if any of you want to see a whole flock of little tiny birds that are really cute, bring your binoculars and go hang out at the senior center in the parking lot for a little while.
And when I walk by the female trees on my property, cedar waxwings, if the fruit are still hanging on there midwinter, which they usually are, will be swarming in there and feeding on them and doing their usual feeding thing of eating until they're full to the brim. And they're obviously having a great time. So it's great for wildlife. Very limited issue with reseeding. That's one of the cool things about Chinese pistachio. I do want to mention one thing. Yeah, they're about 10% of the trees in Davis now. Either by count or canopy. And what that means is that that's a very high percentage of one species. That concerns us a bit. We don't want to see whole new neighborhoods going in where they plant like a whole street of Chinese pistache. Let's keep the numbers down to 10% because that's actually kind of a rule of thumb in urban forestry. You get more than 10% of one species. Well, what if a disease problem comes along that hits Chinese pistache and then you've lost a significant chunk of your canopy? So there is a hybrid that's on the market, Red Push Pistache. It's a cross between two other species of Pistacia. It is a hybrid, so its seed is not viable. And in fact, it's a male cultivar, either grown from seed typically as non or from grafting more commonly. I've noticed it both ways, interestingly. So there's some question about its complete provenance, but it is not going to reseed. It has a nice flush of red growth in the spring, hence the name Red Push, and great fall color. So if you're getting a tree, for example, from Tree Davis, we're out planting trees this winter. We're not doing Chinese pistachio just because there's so many of them, not because there's anything wrong with it. We're just concerned that there's so many of them, but we are doing the Red Push pistachio because it's a different parentage. And so we want to get a little different genetics out there. Home gardener, sure, if you want to plant a tree out front, Chinese pistachio is still a great choice. But I already had one person ask, why are you doing this one instead of the other one? Well, because we want to get some more genetic diversity into the street tree, into the urban forest. Biggest mistake in urban forestry historically over the last, let's say, 300 years. Too much of one thing. Yeah. That's a simple lesson we've all learned. You know what the very first tree was that was imported to the U.S. to plant as a street tree? Ailanthus altissima, the tree of heaven.
Oh, and no.
That's a big mistake. We all know that now. So we've learned to a little more diversity, a little more testing. Testing for invasiveness is something we should definitely be doing. Let's all plant elms all the way down the main boulevard. Ooh, they're all dying of Dutch elm disease. Let's not replace them all with anything. Let's replace them with 10 different species.
A bunch of different species.
So, you know, that's the only reason that Chinese pistache is not being heavily planted by the city. As you, as a homeowner, put one out front, that fall color is great. If you want reliable fall color, get the Keith Davey male cultivar and you won't have the berries to deal with. And of course, the cedar waxwings in your neighborhood will have to go somewhere else.
I want to talk about our listeners who are not in Davis. I really like this pistache tree that we have so much of in Davis, and that Keith Davies is gorgeous. What areas can that grow in? How wide a range does that Keith Davies have?
Well, I'll just get out my Sunset Western Garden book here.
Oh God, I'm so envious.
What we always used to say. Yep, and Pistacia chinensis zones 4 through 16 and 18 through 23. Now, that's an interesting range of zones.
Beautiful.
Zone 4 takes you down to a very cold climate. This is not USDA zone. This is sunset zone. So that gets pretty cold. 18 to 23 is all of Southern California except the coastal zone I grew up in, zone 24. And you notice it goes 4 to 16, 18 to 23. So 17.
17.
That's Berkeley. That's a coastal Northern California, coastal Southern California. But as long as you're in just a little bit from the coast, it should do fine. So it can take very cold conditions and very unfussy tree. I mean, where I live, there's several of them that Caltrans has on the highway side that don't get irrigated at all. And they're doing absolutely fine. So it's a very tough tree, very adaptable. But also, unlike some trees that are very drought tolerant, it also is just fine with irrigation. It's great in the lawn. It's great, you know, although it'll shade out the lawn eventually. Yeah, they're tough trees. The first ones that turn color locally are typically the ones along Highway 113, which, as I understand, were seedlings that were selected for fall color. That's where I got the idea for my own little grove. And they look great, and they turn color as early as October, partly in that case, I think, because they're completely unirrigated. So perhaps some drought stress is leading to earlier fall color. Those are seed grown. If you remember the colors, you'll notice it's not all uniformly red or orange. There's some mix of colors in there. That's what happens when you get seedling grown Chinese pistache.
So Don, Kathy, and that's Kathy O.
Yep.
From Davis, writes, last year Don recommended we buy an Okitsuwase citrus tree at his nursery. I just want to say we are now harvesting our first ripe fruit, and the Okitsuwase is a winner. We've gotten around 30 fruit on a small tree in a pot, and she sends a picture, thank you.
Yeah.
The fruit is delicious, sweet with a touch of tartness, and so easy to peel.
Yeah, I've had some questions about this one. It's Okitsu, O-K-I-T-S-U, Wase, W-A-S-E. Anyone who knows Japanese, correct me if I'm wrong. I think that just means early, but I'm not absolutely sure. And it is a Satsuma mandarin. Mandarins fall into two or three different categories. The best known mandarin is the Owari Satsuma. That's the one they're beginning to show up in the stores now, but they really show up around Thanksgiving, coming out of Newcastle, uphill from Sacramento. It's the classic mandarin orange. It's seedless. It's easy to peel. It's very sweet, but got also the tartness, that perfect balance of acid to sweet. And it is the first one to ripen that's commercially available. Okitsuwase is earlier than Owari Satsuma. When I planted my new mandarin orchard, I hadn't tasted this one, so I wasn't absolutely sure, you know, how good it was, but it apparently ripens as early as late October, early November, which would be great. That as an early maturing Satsuma mandarin that has great potential. So this is really useful information. I have a few of them planted at the start of my mandarin orchard, and they'll be the very first ones we would be harvesting, again, early November. Whereas my experience with Owari Satsuma here, which I have a number of, is they're okay at Thanksgiving. I mean, the kids would always go out and harvest some, but they were still quite tart. What happens when you get some chilling is that the acid, as they described it to me years ago, converts to sugar, or there's less acid and more sugar, or some combination of those things is happening inside the fruit. You need some chilling to make the fruit sweeter. And so as we get to Thanksgiving, we haven't had that much of that chilling, but uphill a little bit, you get to Loomis and Rockland and Newcastle, where they're upslope a bit, where they get a frost a few weeks before we do. They get the sweetness before we do. And they also, this is real important from a commercial standpoint, they also color up earlier, so they're ready to go to market. Owari Satsuma is the first commercial mandarin, but this Okitsu Wasi has been highly recommended. And I just pulled up a blog here. This is called the, the Fruit Mentor. It was their taste test winner, interestingly. So it's they tested a bunch of mandarins. Now, I'm not sure how they did that, having them all maybe over a period of time or something like that. But in the November 2014 citrus taste test of 60 varieties, Okitsu Wasi Satsuma was the overall winner. Wow. Tasters reported it to be sweet with excellent flavor, very juicy. One taster also noted its fragrant skin. And on a scale of 1 to 9, it rated 7.3, which is the highest on that taste test. And he says, I juiced the leftover fruit and had planned to use it in an experimental recipe, but it was so delicious, I decided to drink it rather than take the risk of wasting it. So that's really good. Okitsu Wasi, very early. I have a grower that's been doing it pretty consistently, so it's one that I typically have. If you come in to talk to me about mandarins, you may find the conversation is more complex than you thought it was going to be. But I have Okitsu Wasi, which is early. Dobashi Beni, which is a variant of Owari Satsuma that has redder flesh. That's always exciting to growers. Owari Satsuma, that gets you through January right there. And then you've got your Clementines and your Tango and your Shasta Gold and your Gold Nugget. And Gold Nugget starts ripening in April and hangs on the tree to midsummer with no problem. I picked a Gold Nugget in late August last year, and it was great. So to have a mandarin you can actually pick in the summer and have not insipid fruit, but really flavorful fruit, is pretty unusual. So you could start in late October, early November with Okitsu Wasi and go to midsummer with Gold Nugget, have mandarins for, 8 months of the year. That's pretty good.
I wanted to talk about the picture that got sent with this. So this tree, it's a small tree. It's going to be less than shoulder high when I'm standing in front of it. And that's pot included.
Yeah.
The pot is smaller than a half barrel. It's one of those big, heavy ceramic pots, the terracotta, kind that breathe a little bit, and it's not plastic. And then right next to it is another big pot, not quite as big. Mm-hmm. And lime in there. Can you tell what that is from that picture?
It's either a Meyer lemon or a lime, one of those two. And again, those are great container plants. When people come in looking for citrus for containers, I usually will steer them towards Meyer lemon, lime, calamond, and things like that. Mandarin, of all the orange-like things, mandarins are probably your best choice, because things like navel oranges, the plants are just going to try and get too big. But look at this. It's got 20, 30 fruit on it. It's in a container that's smaller than a half barrel. Obviously, you can't keep it in that container forever. If you are going to, I just had this conversation yesterday with someone who wanted a mandarin, wanted to keep it in a pot because they didn't have a place in the ground to put it. And I said, that's all fine. You can keep plants in containers forever as long as you give them what they need, which is water and nutrients. And in the case of water, it may be, almost certainly will be, daily watering once it's root bound, which a citrus in a container will be by its second full summer. And the nutrients, probably best to feed a citrus in a container once a month. Year round is fine, at least spring through fall, just to keep the nitrogen on the plant, to keep it growing and looking good. But you can certainly keep a smaller citrus in a container for a few years, as long as you give those basics, the water and the nutrients. This came up in the context of the usual question. I'm looking for that true dwarf citrus. Well, I think we addressed this a couple weeks ago. True dwarf citrus is not on the market. That rootstock is gone. Nobody's growing anything that stays like a little tiny bush. But there are slower growing, more compact, and earlier fruiting citrus that can be done in containers. Again, the Meyer lemon, Calamondin, Rangpur lime, things like that. And mandarins within the category of oranges, I will go ahead and encompass them. I would say mandarins are probably your best choice for at least a few years in a container. In the ground is going to be easier in the long run.
Now, you got diverted back to citrus again. What I was looking at and wanted to describe for our listeners is this picture shows her yard. Mm-hmm. And there is a brickwork on the ground underneath these citrus pots. Mm-hmm. And there's a birdbath right next to it, right next to it. No problem with that. And then off the brick, There are wood chips in rows to make walking paths.
Yeah.
And beyond that is another portion of the garden. And it looks like she has some tomato cages out there. Some are those dahlias? They look
Say
almost
probably
like dahlias.
zinnias look like zinnias to me. What I also notice as a practical person is that there's a drip water line going up into this container with the mandarin in it. And I think that's really important. There's a drip line coming off of a supply line in the ground nearby so it can get watered more or less automatically, or all the container plants can be watered together. Just talking to some older customers who have a lot of container plants, and it's becoming quite a chore for them to hand water them. So what you really should look into is running a half inch water line behind all your container plants and just run a little thing up into each one. And in the summer here, if that ran every day for a few minutes, that would take care of it rather than trying to drag a hose out there and deal with it one by one. So that's one thing. The first thing I noticed was the watering system.
Okay, and going back to Kathy's email, she continues, "I'd love to hear a whole show on citrus. There are so many great varieties you don't often see in the grocery store. You could plant a sequence of trees to have fruit beginning in October through spring and summer. I like your thoughts on the best size pots to grow citrus, how often to water, and how often to fertilize. Many thanks for your show. I always learn something new."
So the
Well, we
best
talked
size.
about a lot of citrus. Do you think we actually need a separate show
Oh, I
now?
think we could do a whole show on the unusual citrus people can grow that you don't see in the grocery store. That's a fun one. And also some of the ones that you do see in the new marketing programs in the grocery store as to what those are. You know, when something new like the sumo mandarin comes along, what exactly is that? And the sequence of trees that, well, I think we just described October to midsummer is something you can easily accomplish. In my opinion, the best size pot for citrus is going to be one that holds 3 cubic feet of soil at least. And that's the equivalent of a half wine barrel. There's certainly clay and plastic pots that are that size as well. But a couple of a simple data point I've come down to grow anything in a pot, you need at least 1.5 cubic feet of soil, tomato, basil, pepper, whatever. And for a woody plant, you probably need at least 3 cubic feet of soil. That's just my own experience, but it really seems to hold across those two categories, herbaceous plants, woody plants. They still are likely in our climate here in the Central Valley to need water every day in the summertime. And of course, you have to manage the nutrients. A bunch of different ways to do that. And with citrus, that'd be an easy topic.
You say at least 3 cubic feet. I can't think of anything that would be more than that, except for those troughs, the cattle troughs.
Livestock water troughs. Yes, and that's a good option. In fact, a lot of people are going to those partly because wine barrels, one, are getting harder to get and the quality just hasn't been there. They fall apart after a few years. Well, a livestock trough takes 15 years to rust. I mean, they last a lot longer and they hold a bigger volume. When I was doing blueberries, I wanted to do a big blueberry planting to test all the different varieties. I just got a couple of 6 foot long, 3 foot deep, 2 foot wide troughs, and I put 3 blueberries into each one of those. Also, ran a drip line for it so I could water it 2 to 3 times a week. Worked great. That actually held them very well for 3 or 4 years. At some point, a woody plant will even outgrow something like that. Then you have to make a decision about what you're going to do. Are you going to try and sort of stunt it and keep it in a container, like almost like a bonsai? Well, you can do that. Or you're going to find a place in the ground for it. But again, minimum 3 cubic feet of soil for a woody plant. A woody plant includes a blueberry, a rose bush, a tree of any kind, that kind of thing. I have lots of those. To me, the 15-gallon container, which holds 1.5 cubic feet of soil, is the minimum, and that's what I often start these things in. I have a bunch of trees that I'm growing in my backyard in 15-gallon containers. By the third year, they're root bound in those. So bigger soil volume is going to be important for something like that. The bigger, the better, because we're in a hot, dry climate and dry wind, a day like, you know, days like we're having today, with, you know, with the north wind blowing 10% humidity, you might have to water twice a day in a smaller container, but a bigger pot would just give you that much of a better margin of error. Another trick, of course, is to have it on the ground where the roots can go into the soil below. That only becomes a problem if you decide to move it at some point. So, yeah.
Well, they're not going to go through the bottom of that trough.
Probably not. No, that would be unlikely. Although I do drill holes in the bottom of the trough when I do them. So.
Yeah, well, those are drain holes, not root holes,
Oh,
right?
hey, roots will find anything. They'll find a way. Okay.
So, Don, you've been coming up with all this citrus information, and where do you get all that information?
When I'm looking up a particular variety, I go to the UC Riverside Givaudan Citrus Variety Collection. And you can just Google UC Riverside Citrus Collection and you'll get there. UC Riverside for decades has had an extremely valuable, important collection of citrus varieties with tons of information. It's the kind of technical information that researchers want. You as a gardener might find it a little overwhelming in some cases, but it tells you where they came from, what the parentage is, and so on, and gives you the details of the plant and has pictures. Pictures of the mature trees and what they look like, pictures of the fruit cut in half so you can see what it looks like. It's one of my first go-to points for any new variety. Part of it is that this particular collection of citrus provides budwood to growers as well as the public. You can buy budwood. If you're good at grafting or budding, it's not cheap, but you can go on there and they sell it and they will send it to you and it's guaranteed disease free because that's what they do. And so if you're interested, usually your local rare fruit growers, California Rare Fruit Growers Association, those folks know all about it, whether it's your Sacramento chapter, Southern California, San Diego chapter, or whatever. They know about this collection. And oftentimes they'll pool their resources and buy budwood together cooperatively because you don't need a whole bunch of it if you're just testing budding or grafting. But the main thing is there's tons of information. citrusvariety.ucr.edu. So that's Citrus Variety. UCR stands for UC Riverside. .edu, and you'll get all kinds of information there. There's another great citrus page, citruspages.free.fr, which I also make use of, and it's an extraordinary compendium of information about all kinds of different citrus. That's my go-to source for whether or not some citrus comes true from seed. They have a whole chart there on that one. But for the basic information about varieties and their ripening dates, at least in Southern California, and the characteristics of, I mean, someone uploaded decades of tasting and testing data on these citrus. You can go in there and some varieties, you can find exactly what the degrees Brix was on all the samples they did. It's very, very informative if you're into that kind of thing. So that's the citrus collection at UC Riverside. And then the other one is at citruspages.free.fr, which has amazing amount of information about citrus. Little program note, I guess we could call this. Someone said they wanted a copy of the document that I had mentioned. Just send a note to get the document from Don and Lois. Tanya and Tara both mentioned this, and I couldn't remember which document it was. Neither could they. So it turns out, Tara, thank you very much. It was the one about sidewalk strip plantings, and I will find that chart and information and get that back to both of you that have requested that. So that was, if any of you are interested in a list of plants that I had come up with at some point for what we call that hell strip between the sidewalk and the street that's usually unirrigated and gets stepped on, all that kind of stuff, send it to davisgardenshow@gmail.com and I'll send you a copy of it. And if you have questions or comments or anything, davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
Well, I didn't get a new quote from the internet this time, so I'll just give you one of mine.
Okay.
Where did I put that fork? Or rake or whatever. I mean, keeping track of your tools is always a challenge.
I suggest that all tool manufacturers make all of their tools hot pink or hot orange. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.